Welcome to Powering Michigan's Future on News Talk 760 WJR.
Brought to you by the National Electrical Contractors Association of Southeastern Michigan and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 58. The best contractors, the best electricians, period.
Now, here's your host, Rick Mason.
Good evening. Welcome to Powering Michigan's Future. Tonight, we're going to take a look at Michigan State House Bill 4561, dubbed by some as the technology torpedo. And we'll also get an update on the Great Lakes Global Freight Gateway, an initiative and coalition of stakeholders looking to leverage our region's existing assets to develop Michigan into an intermodal freight hub. Tonight, we'll begin with Tom Bowes, Assistant Training Director of the Electrical Industry Training Center, and John Easter, Midwest Region Director of State Affairs for the American Chemistry Council. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with Powering Michigan's Future on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now, back to Powering Michigan's Future on WJR. Once again, your host, Rick Mason.
Welcome back to Powering Michigan's Future here on News Talk 760 WJR. Tonight, we're going to kick the show off with Tom Bowes, the Assistant Training Director of the Electrical Industry Training Center, and John Easter, who is joining us on the phone. And John's the Midwest Region Director of State Affairs for the American Chemistry Council. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us this evening.
Pleased to be here.
Tom, if I may, let's begin with you. Can you tell us a little bit about House Bill 4561 and what exactly is it calling for?
Well, basically what it's calling for is to amend the State Construction Codes Act to allow the lengthening of the adoption cycle for new codes. Typically, codes are updated on a three-year cycle, and that has been the norm for the state of Michigan and a number of other places over the years. And so what this bill would basically do is it would essentially push back the code update cycle from 3 years to up to 6 years.
So in essence, it can double it.
Yes.
And given the fact that, you know, we've got new technology all the time, actually things are developed much faster. If you look at what's been developed over the last 100 years, where we had nothing, and then we had the telephone, the television, everything else, and so much happened in the last 50 years, and now they're talking about doubling this amount of time, whereas, I mean, we're a society that we're turning new things out all the time.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think everybody's aware that the technology does keep increasing in its pace, you know, that things that we hadn't even dreamed of 5 or 6 years ago now are being installed in buildings, and the new technology that's coming along, especially energy infrastructure technology, is something that will create tremendous job opportunities, you know, not only for research and development firms, but for manufacturers and for the people that I represent, electrical contractors and their installers.
Okay, now, the current code cycle's 3 years. They're talking about something that's going up to possibly 6 years.
Yes.
Is that pretty much germane for the state of Michigan with the 3 years? What do other states do? How do we fall in that?
Most states stick fairly close to a three-year schedule. Some are mandated, as it has been traditionally for Michigan. Other ones do it more or less voluntarily. But what you find nationally is that they tend to stick fairly close to the three-year national code adoption cycles. Just simply because if you look at it in terms of code adoption, there's a delay built into the process right up front because of the fact that we only deal with these things every 3 years. So, for example, the 2011 National Electrical Code has been adopted in a number of states now, and more states have it on the agenda to go ahead and get that adopted this year. But the 2014 National Electrical Code, the cutoff for submissions for new proposals on that code is in November of this year, to give you an idea of the amount of lead time. Because basically what happens is after the code comes out, you have a year for submissions, you have a year for evaluation, and a year for final approval and printing, and then it hits the market, so to speak. and then is adopted by the municipalities as being the regulation as far as how things will be installed.
Okay, so for companies who are making new products in our state, this basically is going to mean to them that they will put this in line, as you say, and wait twice as long.
Essentially, yes. The problem that's created by delaying the code update cycle is that you have to recognize that when you as a customer or as an architect or designer want to incorporate something into a building, the primary reference document for determining whether that installation is acceptable and safe is the code. You know, be it the mechanical code, the plumbing code, the electrical code. You know, basically your code official is going to look at that document and say, well, if what you're proposing is within the document, if it's been incorporated in, and I can look at it and see that, all right, this is referenced and this is, you are proposing installing it in a safe fashion, then we can have the go ahead in fairly short order to go ahead and incorporate that into a building.
But that code enforcement person's kind of like a referee in a football game. If it's not in the rule book, you can't do it.
That's really the essence of it right there. If it's not in the rule book, there's very few of them that will step out and say, okay, I'm going to give you special permission to do this, even though it's not in the book.
Okay. And for lay people, people who want to build a house, developers who want to build buildings, people in medical professions who want to build a medical building, all that, that's going to affect them how?
Well, essentially what happens is if our codes are not kept up to date, the process is slowed down. That it results in appeals by the person who wants to go ahead and incorporate the new technology, but they have to get special permission to do so. And so there's an additional cost for that. One of the arguments in favor of House Bill 4561 is that it would reduce the costs of purchasing code materials, you know, the reference documents. The problem with that approach is essentially it shifts the cost over to the customer, because then rather than having it be a straightforward, okay, it's in the code book, go ahead and do it, now it forces an appeal to the building authorities to say, well, we want permission to go ahead and do this. And so there are additional costs not only for the customer but for the government, because the appeals process has a cost associated with it.
Absolutely. And when you talk about materials, I'm sitting here thinking, well, don't they carry an iPad and they can just look it up digitally? I mean,
well, and that's part of the problem. When you're dealing with codes, they are written documents. You know, we live in this Google age, but we're kind of stuck with Gutenberg when it comes to codes, because it's an iterative document based on a reiterative process that, okay, the industry has agreed that every 3 years we will go through and we'll have this reiterative process and we'll evaluate where we're at, what technological developments have occurred, and then we will incorporate the ones that we have reasonable assurance that we understand the underlying technical issues to do the installation safely and properly.
Let me go to John, if I may. John Easter, the Midwest Region Director of State Affairs for the American Chemistry Council. John, can you tell us a little bit about the American Chemistry Council and exactly what your group does?
Sure, and thanks for having me on your show. The American Chemistry Council is America's oldest trade association of its kind. It represents companies engaged in business of chemistry, an innovative $720 billion enterprise that is helping solve the biggest challenges facing our nation and the world. The business of chemistry drives innovations that enable a more sustainable future. It enhances safety through the products of chemistry and investment in research, and it creates nearly 800,000 manufacturing and high-tech jobs, plus 5 million related jobs that support families and communities. Now, in Michigan, the chemistry industry provides almost 26,000 jobs, and for every job in Michigan's chemistry industry, 5 jobs are created outside the industry. So, many of them are involved in the innovation and production of energy efficiency products.
So your members would be affected how, specifically?
Well, you know, when we talk about this issue, we like to think of the message into three parts, okay? And first, we like to focus on the homeowners themselves. Before I get to our members, let's focus a little on homeowners. Energy bills are the second highest cost of home ownership next to people's mortgage. Michigan families deserve energy efficiency homes that help them stay in those homes by reducing the cost of ownership. Study after studies show that families can save thousands of dollars in energy costs during the years they live in an energy efficiency residence, and savings continue for each family that purchased the home, so it continues over and over. Insurance premiums are also lower for homes that are energy efficient, and savings from energy efficiency upgrades far exceed the cost of the upgrades.
And so this bill, in essence, will kind of impede the opportunity to become more energy efficient with the homes because the approval time is going to be stretched out, correct?
Absolutely. And energy efficiency, buildings are responsible for 40% of our nation's consumption and two-thirds of its electricity use. So the energy portion of Michigan's building code helps ensure that new homes and buildings in the state use the latest energy efficient materials and technologies, which saves energy and enhances sustainability. That's a key contribution to our overall energy supply. So beyond homeowners specifically, everyone benefits from energy efficiency on buildings, whether residential or commercial. And finally, back to how it affects our members, is this energy efficiency is it's about promotion of jobs. Energy efficient products and processes, technologies, innovations, some of them created by Michigan's chemistry industry, support jobs and help grow the economy. And again, for every job in Michigan industry, five are created outside the industry.
And we know the economy is something that we all are very concerned about. We're going to talk more about this in just a minute. We need to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with Tom Bowes and John Easter here on Powering Michigan's Future, right here on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Powering Michigan's Future with Rick Mason, only on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Powering Michigan's Future. We've been discussing House Bill 4561, which proposes a change to the cycle that updates building codes from the current national standard of every 3 years to every 6 years. We're joined by Tom Bowes, Assistant Training Director of the Electrical Industry Training Center, and John Easter, Midwest Region Director of State Affairs for the American Chemistry Council. John, we were just talking a moment ago about how the economy would be affected, your members and jobs and things like that. So if we could just continue a little bit more on what the House Bill 4561 would do, how it would have an effect on technology development in Michigan, which up to this point, really, we've been doing really well.
Well, Michigan, I think, has been a leader in technology and innovation. The three-year cycle has been in place, I think, since 1972.
Yes, that's correct.
And for the code updates, the choice of the state to update energy efficiency has led to homes made with advanced materials. It's saved consumers energy and money, and it's benefited people who are involved in providing the products and technology, the manufacturing, the innovation.
Okay, if we can look at some of the implications of what maybe the government's thinking. Number one, obviously, as Tom had shared with us earlier, is that, well, they'll have to publish less, which will save money. The appeal process will go up. It sounds like that's going to cost money. If you take the technology products that are being produced in Michigan, that's going to slow that down. That sounds like that's not going to save the state any money. So how will this really slow down the adoption of new products, and what will that mean? Will that work go to other states?
You raise a good question about other states. I'm concerned that Michigan will start to lag behind other states. While, for example, Illinois is on track in the year 2012 to update its code to the 2012 that just was released this last summer. So they'll be far ahead, and they continue on a three-year update, while if Michigan, which just recently went to the 09 and then waited 6 years, we're talking an update to for another 6 years out from now. And that would put the homeowners behind in energy savings. And innovation would be hampered by that.
Well, and you know, talk from the with the new administration here in Michigan is that we need to be more business friendly. We need to you know, maybe streamline regulation and things like that. So, what kind of feedback are you getting from legislators or from Governor Snyder on this? Have they? I guess, opined on this?
Well, we hear mixed things from legislators right now. Obviously, there are some that support this, but I think as they further examine the impact that the legislation will have, they'll realize the importance of the energy savings to everyone and to homeowners specifically. And we know the governor wants to streamline rulemaking process, and we think there could be ways perhaps to do that without going to a six-year cycle here. For example, perhaps home builders could have more members on the rulemaking process or another step in the process that give them a voice to help that view.
Okay. We're talking to John Easter, the Midwest Region Director of State Affairs for the American Chemistry Council, and Tom Bowes, the Assistant Training Director of the Electrical Industry Training Center. Tom, you teach and work the code pretty much every day. Now, do you see a need for this change?
Absolutely not. If anything, you know, in an ideal world, we would have something less than a three-year cycle, but you have to recognize that codes are developed by industry, and there's only a certain amount of resources that industry will commit to that process. You know, if everybody understands that, okay, it's a three-year timeline that we can work with, that gives us an opportunity to kind of collect our thoughts and do our submissions. It's really not a big issue. There's a slight lag involved. But the key concept is, you know, you have code adoption, and then you have an educational process which occurs after the fact. When we're going to educate building code officials, electrical inspectors, plumbing inspectors, whatever it happens to be, and then contractors and, in my case, electricians, all of those things need to happen in a sequential fashion, and they need to happen fairly quickly. You know, that if you let it linger too long, and especially if we have like two iterations of a national code to one iteration of a state code, now it becomes more difficult to pick out, all right, which areas do we need to emphasize out of those codes in order to make sure that architects, engineers, contractors, installers, and inspectors have a good background and understanding of what the changes have been and what they mean for the industry.
Okay, we have about a minute left. So if there, and I put this both out to you, Tom and John, what would you like our listeners to do? Making themselves aware about House Bill 4561, what should they do?
I think they should contact their legislators and let them know that they support the three-year cycle and energy efficiency gained from it. Energy efficiency is the cheapest form of energy development.
Okay, Tom?
Yeah, and we have to keep in mind it's not just energy efficiency. Electric vehicles, photovoltaics, wind systems, you know, all these things with on-site power and bidirectional power transfer between the grid and the building are all up-and-coming technology, and we need to support that by keeping our codes up to date.
Okay. Well, we've been talking to Tom Bowes, the Assistant Training Director of the Electrical Industry Training Center, and John Easter, Midwest Region Director of State Affairs for the American Chemistry Council. We've been discussing Michigan State House Bill 4561. These gentlemen encourage you to please become aware of it, educate yourself about it. And once you begin to think about the implications they've shared here this evening, take action. Call your legislator. Tell them what you think. That's what they're there for. They're there to serve us. And we, you know, we have a great state here. We want to keep it moving in the right direction. And Tom and John, I thank you both very much for being guests with us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
We'll be back in just a minute or so with more of Powering Michigan's Future, right here on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now, back to Powering Michigan's Future on WJR.
Brought to you by the National Electrical Contractors Association of Southeastern Michigan and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 58. The best contractors, the best electricians, period.
Once again, here's your host, Rick Mason.
Welcome back to Powering Michigan's Future on News Talk 760 WJR. We're continuing our conversation this evening with Mike Belzer, the Associate Professor of Economics at Wayne State University and also President of Great Lakes Gateway Incorporated. And we're joined also by Steve Landis, member of the Gateway Executive Committee, and Bob Dabrowski, Director of the Industrial Global Supply Chain Group for Newmark Knight Frank. Gentlemen, welcome. Mike, we're going to start with you. Give us a snapshot of the Gateway Implementation Plan and your vision.
Well, this plan is designed to transform Southeast Michigan into an inland port, which would be a major aggregator of freight coming from the rest of the world through a gateway and a freight corridor in Halifax, Nova Scotia. So essentially you have an axle with two hubs at either end, the Halifax axle. This is an auto analogy.
Mm-hmm.
The Halifax gateway port at one end, the Michigan gateway at the other end, and the axle is the CN Railway, which is one of the largest railroads in North America and one of the two transcontinental railroads. So it gives us access to global freight transportation.
Which obviously gives us a great leg up economically.
Well, that's right. It gets us an access to global markets that we really haven't had. For a long time, for really well over 100 years, Chicago has been the dominant inland port in North America and the United States. And what's happening is there's a growing kind of deconcentration of these inland ports because there's so much congestion in Chicago and there's so much population elsewhere that the companies need to be able to get into and out of other regions of the country much more effectively and much more inexpensively. And so if you think about it, there's a radius of about 200 miles around every one of these nodes that are sweet spots for marketing freight transportation into and out of a region. And Detroit is in a great spot that catches southwest Ontario, all of Michigan, and down all the way down to Columbus, Ohio, really. And that whole region is now will be now accessible to us from an economic perspective, which gives us a really a great advantage in reducing the cost of buying and selling commodities around the world.
Okay. Now, this evening, you're not with us. You're on the telephone. You're in Washington, D.C., as I understand it, and you had a big meeting yesterday. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, we had a meeting that was kind of a meeting of the minds between the Halifax Port Authority, the CN Railway, and Great Lakes Global Freight Gateway, and that included some representatives from the state of Michigan, from the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, the Department of Transportation, SEMCOG, other agencies that were are important players in this game. And at that point, we kind of shared our visions with each other. And then once we did that and just talked about it, then we moved on to a meeting with cargo owners, and we invited a substantial number of cargo owners. I never did get the count, but something in the neighborhood of 40 cargo owners to come to talk with us and to talk with CN and Halifax and kind of get our joint vision squared away, get the idea of what we had in mind, and start exploring what the business opportunities are. And so that was our second meeting, and then we had a public rollout in the evening.
Okay. Now, let me turn to Bob Dabrowski, if I may. Bob, you've got a lot of experience with logistics and the development needed to support logistics efforts. Why do you feel that this is important to our region, and how has the response been so far from your customers?
Well, I was surprised at the response that we got. I was the one sort of delegated to contact companies to invite them to this meeting, and we got a lot of support, in fact, from the west side of the state, along with what you'd normally expect in southeast Michigan. And to make you understand a little bit better what this whole operation's about, it's rail and truck oriented, and currently there are four Class One railroads that service the state of Michigan, and two of them have already made commitments for intermodals out of the state, and so they'll be taking our customers and taking them to the state of Ohio, where Norfolk Southern has established an intermodal in the Columbus area at Rickenbacker, and CSX, or Chessie System, has just broke ground last June in a town called North Baltimore outside of Findlay, Ohio. And again, they'll be taking clients or attempting to take clients down to that area. And so that leaves us with only two other Class 1 railroads serving Michigan. And we have an opportunity to get in a partnership with one of them. And I think it's vital for this area because this opportunity won't stay there forever.
Mike, let me go to you for a minute because, you know, there are a lot of transportation or logistic initiatives we're kind of facing. We hear about the Aerotropolis. Of course, we hear about the bridge, whether it's going to be NHTSA or privately built or whatever. How are these going to fit in with Gateway? Then do they compete, or will they all complement each other?
Well, I would say that they all complement each other. They really have different goals and objectives. First of all, ours is an inland port. It's really a transportation system. So there's no freight transportation infrastructure. There's no freight transportation kind of initiative that we don't like. However, it's not been really organized in our view, and so we're trying to systematize that. So there's a NAFTA corridor initiative. There's the TransLink initiative, which has kind of a lot of different partners, potential partners or envisioned partners relative to freight transportation. But ours is really very, very specific, and I think that ours will complement theirs, and theirs will complement ours. And I think it's a matter of finding a way to drive up the mass of freight volume so that we can reduce the cost. When you raise the freight volume in any area, like we're talking about for Michigan, good things happen. It starts reducing the cost. It increases your ability to get greater service quality. And what we really want to have is a unit train a day coming in from these ports that's bringing in freight that has to be handled, removed from the trains, put on trucks, sent to distribution facilities, maybe repackaged, maybe a value add, like a manufacturing value add, all kinds of activities that can happen. But you have to have the freight volume in your area to be big enough for that to be successful. And that's what we're trying to do, is to find a method that's the most likely method of driving up freight volume.
Okay, we've got to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to ask Steve Landis a question about infrastructure. So please stay tuned for more of Powering Michigan's Future on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Powering Michigan's Future with Rick Mason only on News Talk 760 WJR.
Brought to you by the National Electrical Contractors Association of Southeastern Michigan and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 58. The best contractors, the best electricians, period.
Once again, here's your host, Rick Mason.
We're back with Powering Michigan's Future here on News Talk 760 WJR. We're continuing our conversation about the birth of a world-class inland port right here in southeast Michigan. We're talking with Mike Belzer, with Bob Dabrowski, and Steve Landis. And Steve, you're on the Gateway Executive Committee. What do we need to build as far as infrastructure before the Gateway can be implemented? I mean, are we looking at a lot of costs and a lot of building?
Rick, I think the good news is that we don't need to build anything to get started. We have the infrastructure here. We have the road and rail density that's necessary for us to begin increasing the freight traffic. And that as that freight traffic grows, that will dictate the infrastructure additions that need to be made. Largely, they'll be made by private investment because companies like CN will need to expand the capacity in their freight yards. And then, of course, the state will need to be involved when it comes to roads and bridges and access points. But that needs to be dictated by the business growth itself. So right now we can start. We don't need to wait for anything to happen. And then we can grow from there as the business dictates.
So you get it up and running, and then the businesses, companies that use this, they're going to invest in it because it allows them to better serve their customer.
Absolutely. I
mean, it's like R&D. You've got to put money into the business in order to better serve your customer, and then you receive the benefits of that.
Correct, but we have resources that have been built over the years. Rail yards exist here in Detroit that are underutilized at the moment, but they were built, you know, to handle a much larger industry. And we can put those back to work, creating jobs and increasing our business.
Because we really have those resources going to waste.
Absolutely.
Okay. Mike, I sense your urgency with this project. What happens if we wait? What happens if we don't, you know, get rolling with this?
Well, that's there's kind of a risk and a reward here. So we have a chance of becoming a world-class inland port, and we have to act on it and take the initiative and understand what we're trying to accomplish to make it work. If we wait on the project, there's a very good likelihood that infrastructure providers, service providers like CN are going to go to some other places where they can get a more responsive business environment. And they'll want to go someplace where they can expand and do what they need to do, and they'll do it in another state. So the fact is that there's a reorganization of freight resources right now that's happening, and we need to take advantage of it. And we have the advantage because of our location with the short river crossing over to Canada and the access points to Montreal and to Halifax, and in fact all the way to the west coast of Canada as well, where they have very far north ports that make it the shortest distance to Asia. So those are great opportunities to reduce costs for customers. We have to reduce costs for customers or our business base will continue to decline in this area. So there's kind of many things that are happening at once, and one that's very important is to recognize that your businesses, whether they're on the export side or the import side, need to have low-cost transportation. And if some other area provides that low-cost transportation, those businesses will pick up and move elsewhere.
And this also needs to be done because, for example, they're widening the Panama Canal, right? Because they've got to make it bigger because cargo ships are getting bigger?
Yes. The Panama Canal is going to be wider, but it's not exactly clear how big a ships will fit through there. So there's two problems with the Panama Canal. One is it's limited in its size, and about a third of the container ships now in the fleet can't get through the Panama Canal, and that number is growing because the size of container ships is growing.
But
the other problem is it's around the equator, and that's the long way around the world. If you fly from here to Asia, you know you're going to go over the polar route, or you're going to go up to the Arctic Circle anyway when you're going from Michigan. So you're going to have to get as close a route as you can to that on water and on land in order to replicate the close distances. So it's a long ways around to Panama, and it'll be a long ways around to us. So I think to the extent that there'll be more freight going through Panama, it's going to probably sweep up the East Coast with ships of modest size. But there's a series of very big ships on the horizon that are twice as big as the ships that go through the Panama Canal, and those will be going from Europe to Southeast Asia, and Halifax is just a quick little skip across the North Atlantic Ocean to North America from there.
And of course, we'll benefit from working with them, as you had said. That's the one hub, we're the other hub, and then there's the axle in between.
You got it.
So Bob made a point about how businesses on the west side of the state are very excited about this and see what the implications are for them. And would that be primarily because we have a marvelous agricultural base here in Michigan and it would allow us to export?
Yeah, the most important thing you need to know here is that you don't make any money shipping an empty container. So every marine company, the steamship lines, the railroads, they want to ship containers that are full. So every container load of soybeans or cherries or whatever else that's a Michigan product that we can fill the containers with to ship outbound will help enhance the value of our agricultural industry. And at the same time that it's doing that, it reduces the cost of the manufacturing industry that is importing manufacturing goods. So as we import manufacturing goods, export manufactured goods, if we have an imbalance, we can fill it with agricultural goods, which are in high demand in Asia, and ship them right out this corridor and save everybody a lot of money and make our agricultural sector much stronger.
Okay, gentlemen, we've got a minute left. What do we do to get started? What do we do? What is the person sitting next to the radio right now, what do they do?
Well, I think one thing that can happen immediately is the cargo owners who are presently beginning to do the request for quotation process for future shipping can include the Halifax route in their request for quotation so that this becomes part of the normal practice. And that's something that can be done immediately. It doesn't cost them anything to do it. And then we'll start getting that feedback on the comparative costs.
Bob?
I think the old normal route of approaching your government officials and telling them how much this is desired for the state of Michigan, it will bring new jobs, new development for the industrial sector, and it's a win-win situation for everybody.
And Mike, we know where you stand, so we're out of time. I'd like to thank Mike Belzer, Steve Landis, Bob Dabrowski. It's the birth of the world-class inland port. Make sure you think about the gateway. And this has been Powering Michigan's Future on News Talk 760 WJR. We'll see you next month.